Good morning, and you are very welcome to Countrywide. Coming up for you before 9 o'clock, the Irish farmer who's now president of the European Economic and Social Committee, legal protection for Donegal Tweed, and volunteers in Offaly breathing new life into clothes and furniture. 51551 for your texts, countrywide at rte.ie for your emails. It's great to be with you. We're going to start in Clare because in 2021, Nick and Cass McCarthy set up Lunasa Farm on 30 acres of land just outside of Quinn in County Clare. Now, neither of them comes from a farming background. Nick is actually an engineer by trade and he met Cass, who is a farmer, while working in her home country of Australia. But together, they're part of a new wave of first generation farmers, young people trying to make a living by producing and selling local food for their own communities. For many, it is a dream life, but the reality, of course, is an awful lot of hard work. Nick and Cass have taken their farm a little bit further by setting up shop in a 100-year-old butcher's in Clare Castle, which they now lease as well. Well, during the week, I called into their farm to see how they're getting on.
Pig, piggies. Pig, piggies. So this is mixed grain that's been rolled twice. So it's organic grain, a combi crop that comes from County Tipperary, from Feathered. There's barley, oats and peas.
Peas, beans.
I think that's about it. Yeah. This combined with the whey, and we mix the odd little bit of crushed seaweed powder in there as well, just for extra minerals. We just try to add that little bit more to try and get them more balanced nutrition.
Have a look at the water.
Check the water, okay. I grew up in Clovelly, which is a seaside suburb of Sydney between Bondi and Coogee. I don't come from a farming family, but I always had a very keen interest in cooking and food and nutrition. That led me to farming. So I spent a good number of years basically doing every course and visiting every farm I could around Australia. It took me over to New York State where I did a livestock apprenticeship at Stone Barns, Centre for Food and Agriculture there. Came back from that and then just spent quite a few years farming various farms in the Northern Rivers, Byron Bay, it's like northern New South Wales.
Then you met an Irish farmer.
I met an Irish farmer. Yeah, we met at a pub.
So tell me about that.
Fireworks. Yeah.
Well, he was standing behind me at the bar and I turned around and his mate knew my friend and they were chatting and he was just standing there. I thought, oh, geez, he's handsome. Started talking to him. I think when he asked me what I did, because at the time I was working full-time managing livestock and growing veggies on a farm locally, I was like, oh, I'm a farmer. And he just... had this really cheeky grin and he was smiling and he was completely silent and I was like, what? And he was like, how did you put it?
I said, I was wondering if it was too early for a marriage proposal.
Yeah. Oh, the Irish
charm. Yeah, no.
So your eyes turned into hearts.
Well, we were engaged within the year, so yeah. Wow. Yeah. It went pretty quick.
That's nice. What were you doing in Australia?
I went over to try and be a rugby player, but that didn't work out. And then
you can't skip over that now. A professional.
I suppose I had grand ambitions, but through injury and whatever else, it didn't work out very quickly actually. But I had a degree in engineering, which I fell back on, and then that got me into a cushy government job where I had lots of free time to go surfing, do whatever I wanted, and
hang out in bars looking for women.
and then just look for a greater meaning in life. And I was never that fond of the engineering anyway.
I presume at the back of your mind, there's a family farm at home in Clare.
Was that something that you had been thinking about?
No. It was never that. It was, could I homestead someday on the side of my real job? But then when I met Cass, life turned upside down.
Yeah. It was something that Nick brought up on our very first date. He just slid it in there that I had intended on moving home. I'm always open to an adventure and trying new things, but I made it pretty clear that if Nick had his heart set on returning to Ireland one day, that I'd definitely be open to it.
Fast forward, 2021, you came back to the farm, you now have two kids. Is this what you always wanted to do?
It is. I need to remind myself of that when I'm wrecked and things aren't going my way, if there's a pig out, you know, this is what we want to do. We're trying to create a business that is nourishing us and the community and the planet. There's a lot of balls in the air, but it's really important.
I love the scratches.
What do the kids call that one again?
Mustard.
Mustard, yeah.
And when will mustard go to the abattoir?
Mustard isn't far off now.
Do the kids know that?
They do, yeah. Well, sure, we killed pickles there 2 weeks ago, and that was pickles was a big favourite. The killing of animals for our own consumption, it's not a scary thing for them. It's not weird.
Have they eaten pickles yet?
Oh, they have, yeah. They said we'll have some chops from pickles, and they enjoyed them, didn't they?
I think it really helps them to respect the animals. They understand and they enjoy the food, and they just get it. It's really nice.
Yeah, but they understand the importance of giving these animals the best life we possibly can as well. Happy animals make the best meat too. So, you know, from a business point of view, it makes sense for us to have happy animals.
Is there much profit to be made off these animals? You're laughing there.
it's difficult, you know. If we weren't doing things like the value adding, we make a variety of sausages, meatballs, cure our own rashers, then we do salamis and cured meats as well as bone broth, lard. If we weren't doing that, then no, there'd be nothing out of them. There's a nice bit of grass here for the cattle.
And you have also a shop in the family, a butcher shop.
Yeah, so we've got the lease in a small butcher shop in Clarecastle. It's a bit of an institution. It's been there for 100 years, so there's great history there. I'm definitely a first-generation butcher. So we're a whole carcass butchery. We sell everything from, like, literally boiling up the bones for bone broth to rendering the fat for tallow. And if we didn't do that, we wouldn't be in business, because the margins are so slim. Meat these days, beef and pork, it's a tricky way to do it.
And of course, beef has been gone up so much in price in the last couple of years as well. In a world where butcher shops are closing down all over Ireland at such a rate, you're pushing against that. What is the public saying to you? What are locals saying to you?
The response has been... it's been great. We kind of didn't know what to expect. You know, our business is possibly 60% online, so we send boxes all around the country with our meat. We have regular Clarecastle, Ennis locals who are into us every Saturday, and they're getting their weekly meat. They're really grateful for us being there. You know, they've become our friends, they've become our community. For a very long time, up until recently, there were two thriving butcher shops in Clarecastle, and now we're back in business, and people are definitely glad to see us. Now it is difficult for people if they walk out of Aldi and walk straight into our shop and they see, whoa, there's a big difference in the price and sausages there, but you're comparing apples with oranges there. I think once people get that, they taste the food and then they keep coming back. So this is just an out farm that we have at the other side of the village. Uh, it, it wasn't really in a lot of use for a lot of years.
So this is where the cattle are?
This is where the cattle are at the moment, yeah.
You can see it's prone to seasonal flooding, this piece of land. It's on the river.
There's about an acre of an island, we call, of high ground. So there's always somewhere where the cattle can get out and stay dry.
And the cattle are looking over. There's white, there's brown, there's red, there's black. What breed do you keep?
So they're predominantly stabiliser and Angus.
Stabiliser will be a new one for non-farmers listening. What's the characteristic of that breed?
Yeah, it's a relatively new breed. I think started in the US. Not huge carcasses, docility, easy calving. They're more suited to a predominantly grass-based system.
Nice beef.
Delicious. That's beautiful.
Yeah,
beautiful beef.
Really beautiful. Yeah. We have found that of all the breeds that we've had, the stabilizers do tend to finish really well on pasture.
And just to describe, we're on a kind of island of grass pretty much all around us. It looks like a huge big lake. Of course it isn't. It's just the river oozing into your fields. There's two swans over there. Cattle look very relaxed.
Oh, they are. They're nice and relaxed. They're well used to human contact. In the height of summer, we're moving them every day.
Thank you. I'll take the dry route.
Yeah, you take the dry.
I think I'll set this up today, and okay. I'm going to leave. We've got some pigs that don't want to get with the program at the moment. So there's two that have been out for about a week now, and they've no interest in coming back for the feed.
Yeah. Have you tried chocolate hobnobs?
No.
No.
We'll give that a go. I'll try anything at this stage.
And report back to me.
Yeah.
Cass, what are your impressions of the local food scene here in Ireland, and how easy is it as a local producer and farmer to stay in business and make a profit?
There are so many fantastic food producers all around Ireland. I just think route to market is really challenging. Supply chains are a challenge. Getting to farmers markets are a challenge. I think there is a huge food scene here and food community, but I feel like there's lots of different bio districts and community groups and advocates, but it's how do you make it easier to connect and provide access and make it easier for farmers to get into this sector.
How could things be made easier?
There are many grants available for farmers and food producers, but unfortunately we don't fit any of those categories because we've been told outright you need to show export potential. So how do you build a local food community when the money is not going towards those people that are trying to do that?
It's crazy, you know, that you're looking at importing as many spuds as we export, and it's like, well, hang on, something not right there, you know. And I think the EU, since the invasion of Ukraine, all that kind of stuff, they've been spooked about food security. Food security is now an issue again. It hasn't been since World War II. You need to think about the model of go big or go home. If small abattoirs are getting shut down, getting taken over by bigger outfits, then where's the food security there? The small producers need to keep going, focusing on locals so that we can literally feed ourselves. Focus on feeding ourselves properly first. And then if there's any left over, sure, we can export that, you know.
I think that's been the biggest surprise here is how hard it is looking at horticulture here. So very few, I think it's less than 1% of the vegetables are grown here in Ireland. And the climate is incredible. I'm surprised, actually, how much can grow here. It's like, why are we not eating Irish apples or eating Irish carrots and cabbages and spuds? There's so much. And I think we really need to focus on, as a nation, feeding the communities, so supporting the small farmers, putting in the food education policies into schools, the knock-on effect on our health, the jobs it's creating, not just on the farms, and but also in all of the kitchen hubs that are cooking the food. It's huge, and all of this directly impacts our health as well, long term.
Are you happy here? Do you think you'll stay here? It's Ireland for good.
Eyes wide open. You know, yeah. we're only a little bit through this journey right now. It's a serious adventure. We miss our friends mostly. Back home, friends and family, yeah. back in Australia.
The beach. and the lifestyle.
And the
sun.
Weather.
Yeah.
And the food.
Yeah, and the food and all the markets. And yeah. Oh, gosh.
But apart from that, it's easier. Perfect here.
Yeah. Apart from that. No, but like Nick said, opening the doors to our shop on a Saturday was the best thing we ever did because it's connected us with the community and some of our closest friends that we've now made here, which has made all the difference.
What you're saying is you're here for the moment and you're going to give it your best shot.
Yes.
And see how it goes. And it's good to keep an open mind anyway about life, isn't it?
Exactly.
Definitely. Yeah. You never know where you end up.
Cass and Nick McCarthy there from Lunasa Farm in Clare. And if you are around Clare Castle this morning, their butcher shop is open, as it is every Saturday morning until 1 p.m. And it is worth going just to see the beautiful shop front. It's a real gem. It's made of those old mosaic tiles that you see in the west of Ireland. And it still reads Powers Family Butcher with a lovely green door. It's fantastic to see it reopened on the main street there serving the locals. You can find out more from Nick and Cass on lunasafarm.ie, and best of luck to them in their farming endeavours. After the break, President of the European Economic and Social Committee is live in studio.
Email countrywide at rte.ie. Countrywide on RTE Radio 1.
51551 for your text. Well, I'm very happy to say that with me in studio this morning is a man who, as a young boy, dreamed of one day becoming an actor. But that dream was cut short at just 13 years of age when he had to leave school to help run the family farm in Offaly after his father became seriously ill. Well, last month he became president of the European Economic and Social Committee, an EU body that gives voice to workers, businesses, farmers and communities right across Europe. Seamus Boland, good morning. Congratulations and thanks for coming in.
Good morning, Ella. Nice to be here.
That is quite a journey from a small farm to heading up a major EU body. How on earth did it happen?
Yeah, I sometimes need time to think, how did it happen? But you take what you got, you know, what life rolls out in front of you, you move on. Wasn't supposed to be leaving school, did. Got used to it. Certain amount of loneliness at the beginning because you're missing your peers. And I kind of one of those freaky lads that like school, which can get you into all sorts of trouble. But look, I got into the farm. It was only 20 acres at the time. A lot of work to be done. Horses only, by the way, no tractors. So you move on, you learn, you go do the courses and you learn from others.
The European Economic and Social Committee, I have to admit, I know very little about it, set up around the time you were born back in the late 1950s. What's its purpose? What does it do?
Its main purpose is to give voice to what's called civil society. In Europe, that's how they describe what we would call community voices. I mean, it represents the trade unions, the employers, and of course, the community sector. It's part of the Rome Treaty, which set up the EU. So despite several attempts to get rid of it, it really can't be got rid of because of the Rome Treaty. And we are one of the five institutions. So it's a bit like the Senate. We process a great deal of legislation coming from the Parliament, coming from the Commission, and obviously to put a slant on it of community voices. I suppose the great thing about what's called an opinion, let's call it a report for simple processing, is if we three very divisive sectors, you know, the unions, employers and the community, actually agree on something major, like a CAP opinion, which will be coming up shortly, then it has major influence in terms of what the Commission do about it or what the Parliament do about it.
So essentially, when new laws are brought in, you look at those laws and then you give your advice and you give a perspective of the people who live around the EU.
Yes, we will bring the voices of civil society in all its forms to that opinion, to that report. And as I said, finding agreement in that arena is quite difficult because you have very diverse interests. Even in the community side, you have the environmental side, you have the consumer side, you have the farmer's side, and that's just three of about seven. So imagine on a CAP opinion, trying to get that through, it requires enormous negotiations, skills from everybody. But it can be done, and we've done it before.
Can you take us back a bit to your childhood in the 50s and 60s on the small Offaly farm that you had? I mean, it's hard to imagine. I mean, electricity was still a novelty. Ireland wasn't in the EU. And poverty was widespread. I mean, you experienced it.
Yeah, I mean, look, we for a lot of rural Ireland, especially the smallholders, it really was a peasant farming system. I mean, you actually, your main objective was to produce enough food, A, for the house, and hopefully sell some things around afterwards. But that was it. That was the price was terrible. Farm development was ridiculous. I mean, I remember the first farm modernization plan just before we joined the EU. It was very modest in what it was trying to do. If you even suggested some of the ideas then, you'd be laughed at because we were really trying to bring something from a very basic system of farming. A lot of horses still doing the farming at the time, small sheds, everything in a completely different scale than it now is. So really the EU made a huge difference to Ireland and to farming when it became a reality.
And can you take us into your own situation there? I mean, 1973, we joined what was then the EEC. How did it make a difference to you?
Well, it opened up opportunities. First of all, there was a proper farm development planning process in place, which allowed young people like me to avail of education courses. I remember doing, there was a 161 course. Some of your listeners, older listeners, will remember the 161 courses. And they transformed our thinking. And our thinking was the problem. We needed to think business, and we needed to think of making the farm actually work rather than some sentimental reason for making it work. And that really was the first transformation. And then the aids and assistance, even the price. I mean, I can clearly remember about 6 months after us joining the EU, cattle prices really went almost through the roof, a bit like now
like
at the
today.
Moment. But it then wasn't a bubble. It was real. And it also allowed us to plan the farm out, which we weren't doing, which we didn't do.
It always struck me that farmers back then were very adept at taking those new opportunities from EU membership, in some ways more adept than working class families in towns and cities were.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I think two things to be said about that. One, Europe at the time was really in a food deficit. Europe was not feeding itself. And so the European policy was designed to really ramp up that. So farmers were really brought into that situation very quickly. I think the other thing was, I would argue that the second point that made the difference in your point about working class would be there were direct educational courses. Máchina Ferma was there as well, of course. But young people like me at the time were literally being dragged into these courses, and that really transformed.
And you mentioned Máchina Ferma. How important was that for you at that time?
Well, it was once said, I was doing an interview once upon a time for a job, and my CV wasn't particularly enhancing, particularly the second level. And one of the interviewers said, we won't go there because Máchina Ferma has been your university. I ended up as a Leinster vice president, but Máchina taught me how to speak, how to do the drama that I was interested in, how to be a leader. It was a real university.
Your farm is on the western edge of Clara Bog, and obviously
yes,
the Midland communities were reared off the bogs. You've often spoken about the importance of the fairness in the green transition in the Midlands, where so many communities have been affected by peat cutting. I just wonder how your new job might help people in the Midlands
Yeah, well, first of all, just on the bogs, I mean, we spearheaded through Irish Rural Link the whole process there of relocation of bogs and managing all that turf cutting and peat initiative. In Bordnamona, we've seen the end of Bordnamona, and now and the ESB kind of alongside it, thousands of jobs. There are a number of opinions that I'm watching in the European Economic Social Committee to enhance the just transition. I mean, we really need to make just transition not just a kind of a talking shop on environmental matters only. It has to include economic matters, and that means real jobs. And, you know, the greatest loser in the Midlands in terms of employment are men. Mm. There were serious jobs there. I worked in Bournemouth for a while myself. You really could make a living. Houses were built on the strength, families settled on the strength of Bordnamona. Now, we are not replacing like we'd like at the moment. And what I am saying, talking to the Parliament only the other day and talking to some of the commissioners who I will be meeting, and I will be meeting President van der Leyen as well, we need to replace the jobs lost with similar jobs. And I don't think we're doing that, and I don't think the Just Transition Fund is frankly tackling that element of it. It's not enough just to talk about doing some greeny things without providing jobs to match. Otherwise, we lose people in the community.
You are finally, Seamus, you're going to be going back and forth to Brussels. Mm. Your life is going to be taken away from the farm. I get a sense from reading about you, your ideal day is a bit of farming, listening to Beethoven and Lyric FM, watching Clarkson's Farm. In between your, what yes. is going to be a very busy schedule for you.
Ah, yeah, it's a great opportunity. 2.5 years particularly, the whole overall mandate is 5, but 2.5 years as president certainly will elevate my situation to a place I don't even know yet. But look, I'm looking forward to it. Mm. Look, the farm will be fine. We're a very simple system. My family and my wife, Jamie, are working on that. So I think we'll be fine.
Well, best of luck with it, Seamus. Stay in touch. Please come back in the new year and tell us how you're getting on.
Thank you very much.
And we're going to stay in Seamus's home county of Offaly now, because across Ireland, repair cafes are springing up. And the idea is very, very simple. Reduce waste, reuse what you can, and give old items from clothing to furniture a new lease of life. Well, Della Kilroy dropped by one of these repair cafes in Tullamore to see the magic happen.
You've a hair dryer, yeah. Not working. You've an electronic item as well. A laptop, perfect.
Just to let you know, we have a mixture of electrical items and then there's items, clothing items, to be repaired.
I'm in Tullamore Library, where a team of volunteers are setting up for their first repair cafe.
What have we got here, Paul?
Yeah, as you can see, it's a very old radio. It was a wedding gift for my parents from, I think it was 1962, and it's like it hasn't worked in years. They're both dead in the last few years, you know, so I'd like to, if we could get it going, that'd be great, you know.
So really, I'm just having a look inside to see if there's any obvious problem with this.
And there's cobwebs everywhere, so it needs a good cleaning.
It's a beautiful piece.
It is. It has a bit of character, I suppose. They don't make them like that anymore.
So would that have sentimental value?
Of course, yeah. Yeah, no, absolutely, yeah. I remember it when I was a kid myself. Like, you know, it was the main radio back in the 70s, like, you know.
So, Jeff, you've managed to get some sound coming out of Jeff.
Some sound, but not the sound of RTE Radio 1, unfortunately.
Listen to that now. Paul here explained the Vintage Society, that maybe they would be able to help me, as that would be a starting point. Yeah.
And this is the school jumper?
It's a school jumper, yeah. Okay. It lasted a whole 12 hours before it got ripped into shreds.
The goal is that you watch me doing this, and then you'll be able to do the next one. We'll learn together, right?
But the joys about kids and clothes is they get pulled and dragged everywhere, so...
Not mine.
Not yours, yeah. Instead of throwing them out, it's just giving them a second life, particularly to get passed down through the kids, from the older to the younger kids, so... great idea, great thing to do. So,
what have you got with you today?
Brought a lamp. Probably have a 10 years bought in an antique shop. So old, it's just a nicer piece than the generics that you buy.
What did you do?
Just rewired it, really. Just it was very. The connections were broke here at the bulb house.
He's going to plug it in now.
Delighted.
It works.
I'm thrilled.
Now she is a little bit wobbly, but like that, she's working, and even a little bit of super glue around the bottom of that.
A champion of the circular economy, engineer Geoffrey Rowe is the driving force behind repair cafes in Ireland.
Yeah, I guess the repair cafes is an international movement started in the Netherlands. Here in Ireland, it's been very popular since probably 2014 is when we did our first one. And like local communities organise them all up and down the country.
So how fixable are a lot of these items?
So you'd be very surprised. A lot of things, people just need to do a bit more kind of maintenance or a bit of cleaning or stuff. So like I fixed plenty of toasters where unfortunately it's just a bit of burnt bread there stuck in the mechanism. And then just people need advice. They need recommendations of maybe if we can't fix the item that they brought along, then we give them maybe maintenance and cleaning tips for when they get a new item that they can last a bit longer.
So you've brought in a chair. Tell me what's wrong with it.
Yeah, I brought in my grand uncle's chair. It's been in our family for years and years, and it got broke a couple of years ago. And we've tried to fix it ourselves a couple of times and failed miserably. So anybody that sits in this chair, we always say before they sit down, just don't lean too hard on it. So I would really love for people to be able to go in and sit comfortably in the chair. There is such sentimental value to it. It's a great chair to just sit and read a book in. I'd be really happy to be able to do that comfortably again.
Excellent. So you've been about half an hour fixing it. How are you getting on now?
I think we're at the final stages now, I think.
At the moment of truth, you're going to flip it over.
See if we can sit in it now this evening. I can't wait. It looks sturdy, doesn't it? It's after taking brute force for some of it. Honestly, I'm thrilled. Because I don't, you know, it is something that means a lot. I know that it seems silly, it's just a chair. But it's just, we've had it for so long and we've got a matching one at home. So my mother has the good one and I've got the kind of broken one. So now we have a pair of fixed chairs, so I'm delighted.
Something to sit on tonight.
Something to sit on tonight. That's my chair now. Nobody else is getting into it.
Della Kilworth there in Tullamore Library. Well, for more about repair workshops near you in Ireland, go to togue.ie, T-O-G.ie.
Welcome to Dior.
It's the Dior Mega Reboot by Jonathan Anderson. La veste minibar. The tweed fabric is flecked with micro sequins. The bar jacket is an icon of Dior, a rite de passage for every Dior designer.
The great thing about Dior is that it had some of the greatest designers in history. So you're kind of like going into the spice cupboard.
Well, that's the voice of Jonathan Anderson, a Northern Irish designer widely regarded as one of the most influential voices in contemporary fashion. Well, he was recently appointed creative director at Dior, and in his very first collection a few months ago, he showcased authentic Donegal tweed, putting Irish weaving on a global stage. While Anderson's tweed was actually the real thing, at the moment, anyone across the world can use Donegal tweed to describe their fabric, whether it was made in Donegal or not. Well, this might stop because the Donegal Tweed Association is applying to get official EU recognition and legal protection. This is known as protected geographical indication status, which will mean that only tweed woven in County Donegal using traditional methods can legally be labelled as Donegal Tweed. Well, joining me on the line is Patrick Temple, CEO of McGee Weaving and a member of the Donegal Tweed Association. And also with us is Blona Gallagher, founder of the Galway Wool Co-op. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Patrick, let's start with this news. And I know there's a 1st of December deadline coming up. What would it mean for Donegal Tweed if you are successful in this application and you get protected geographical indication?
I think, firstly, lovely to be talking this morning on this. I think, firstly, it'll provide a lot of clarity and clear identity to the consumer so that when they see something that's called Donegal Tweed, that it is Donegal tweed. The definition of a Donegal tweed is where you have the colourful nep or burr spun into a natural fibre yarn woven in a plain weave or twill within County Donegal.
And I know the tweed industry was, of course, very strong, but now it's five producers. So there's McNutt's, Studio Donegal, yourself, Miggy Weaving, Malloy & Sons, and the fantastic 86-year-old Eddie Doherty up there as well. Correct. You've all got this shared concern that without protection, anyone around the world, as I said, can call their fabric Donegal tweed. I mean, eventually, if that keeps going on and you can see it being used in Paris on the catwalk, you'll just go out of business, I presume.
Well, we have, fortunately, thank God, we haven't gone out of business yet. And it hasn't been protected. The Donegal Tweed Association would have been founded back in the 1950s. Donegal tweed as a sort of genre and description has been used really since the 1850s, 1860s onwards. So there still is clarity within the marketplace of the genuine article woven within County Donegal, with or without the PGI. But what the PGI does, it adds a lot of clarity. If we see what happened on the agricultural PGIs with Parma ham, it gave a very pure definition from the Parma region. The other key, the best one, there's no such thing as the best thing, but a key one as well is champagne. Champagne for the Champagne region in France and sparkling wine for the other producers outside of that region.
And of course, things like Waterford Blanc in Ireland. I suppose importantly for farmers up there, will your application also mean that it has to be made from Irish wool?
No, it doesn't. It, as long as it's a natural fibre, it doesn't have to be made with an Irish wool. If we go back over the last 200 years, the wool market globally, it's been a global market. You had wool clippers coming in the 1800s from Australia with wool back up to the Bradford, which was a sort of global fibre trading centre. So wool has been a global commodity for a long time. The industry in Ireland and across Europe, where textile traditions have always been very strong, has been using wool from all over. But yes, there is a place for Irish wool. Irish wool also has an opportunity to have its own PGI element.
Blonid Gallagher, I might just bring you in there. The Galway Wool Co-op is a volunteer-run organisation and you support farmers to get fair prices for your wool. And you're trying to revive the use of Irish wool in textiles like Donegal tweed. So this new PGI won't mean that it has to be made from Irish wool. But do you see opportunities, Blonid, in this for Irish farmers to perhaps start, I don't know, using breeds that produce softer wool?
Well, first of all, can I just say that we really do support the work that Patrick and the incredible work the Donegal Weavers Association are doing, because at the end of the day, they're creating employment and they're keeping jobs in that whole Donegal area. And in an era where the lights are being turned out quite a lot in rural enterprises, it's fantastic to see what they're doing. And I think that they should, and any support that we can give them to assist them with this PGI, which would be very important to them, we will endeavour to do that. But what we've done at the co-op is we've identified the fact that Irish wool had originally been used quite extensively in Irish textiles and Irish tweed. And that wool was drawn from a very beautiful breed. She was known as the Lovely White. She was all over Ireland. And she's now being identified by the Department of Agriculture, Food and Marine as she's officially known as the Galway. But unfortunately, when the industry started to, you know, veer towards imported synthetics and imported merinos, a lot of the wool from the Galway just wasn't being used and the breed almost went into extinction. So we found that quite sad. And, you know, we talked earlier on about short supply chains. We listened to Nick and Cass there talking about supply chains. We thought, well, what if we were to create a supply chain so that the industry could actually once again draw on this incredible wool? It's just an amazing wool with so many various applications, from apparel right through to carpets and upholstery.
Is
so
the
we
problem
the supply chain?
Can I ask you, Blonid, is the problem here that the breeds that are kept for meat, their wool just is too scratchy, or is it how the wool is treated? I mean, can you take wool that is too scratchy and soften it up?
Absolutely. So what we did this year is we had a lot of feedback from one of the spinners that had been supporting the Mehel for the last 4 years. And the feedback was coming back to us that they couldn't sell the wool. They were buying it, but they couldn't sell it. So we took advice from our neighbours over the UK. We saw how the trend over there is all going back towards sustainability, authenticity, traceability, and the farmer. The farmer's base being part of the high fashion garments that have been produced over in Britain. And similar to us, they have breeds that are both meat and wool producing. So we looked to take a pilot project to the UK and we brought the wool over there. And what came back, I'm sure everybody will be surprised to say, was beyond stunning. It was soft, it was bouncy, it was wearable, it was next to skin. And this was the same wool that had been processed here in Ireland, but when brought over to the UK, handled completely, handled with care, cleaned differently, spun differently. We have mills here in Ireland that are using Irish wool very, very successfully. We have Cushendale down in Craignamara, Craignamana in County Kilkenny. And they've always been using the native Irish sheep wool in their Irish wool blankets.
I suppose it begs the question briefly, but Blunnett, if you might, could Irish wool go for a PGI?
It is. Yeah, well, our application has been processed currently. We have the draft put together. The lovely white gave its name to the now world iconic Bonine wool. So we have put together our application through the Department of Agriculture because we recognise that PGI are agriculturally awarded to producer groups who are actually working for either food or fibre that's grown on the island. And I think given the great, fantastic support that we're getting from the Department of Agriculture and Food to reintroduce this dual-purpose breed all over Ireland and make her wool available to the likes of, you know, the Donegal Weavers Association and other textile manufacturers. But can I just say one thing, Ella, and I will
be quite brief.
I think we have to just recognise the work that Patrick and the weavers are doing in Donegal. You know, it enables people to be able to purchase a fibre, a textile that's actually manufactured in the island,
yes,
versus the wash of manufacturers that aren't even weaving in Ireland. They're not even, not only are they not sourcing their wool from Ireland, but they're not manufacturing their products in Ireland, unlike the weavers in Donegal who are employing people. And we'd like to just differentiate that and to just highlight to the consumer that a lot of the products that are allegedly Irish woven aren't even woven in Ireland.
Thank you, Blunnett Gallagher. We're going to have to finish it there. But thank you very much, your co-founder of the Galway Wool Co-op, for joining us this morning. And Patrick Temple as well, CEO of McGee Weaving and a member of the Donegal Tweed Association. Best of luck with your application. And I gather the results, the yes or no, will come early next year. Well, to end this morning, a short piece from Mary Reynolds, a writer based in Wexford.
Hidden behind the alder tree, I watch as a fox snuffles through the brambles, looking for the last of the blackberries. Scant pickings now. Holding my breath, it feels like I'm looking through the veil, a world we have pushed to the edges of ours. Shifting my weight, I crack a dry branch beneath, startling the fox, sending her at speed back to safety. I long for her to come back, for the branch not to have snapped. But it is what it is. My dad used to tell me stories about when he was young, out farming on this land that I live with. The sun would be blocked out for a moment as swarms of migrating butterflies or flocks of birds passed overhead. He used to catch trout from the stream to the south, now a brown trickle in a deep ditch. These stories align with a concept called shifting baseline syndrome. Most of us have forgotten what it's supposed to look, sound and feel like out there. That Ireland's natural world was once a different place. With every passing generation, our concept of what is natural has shifted. The abundance of wildlife that my dad experienced was a depleted version of his parents' experience, and so on. Everything we are comes from the earth. Our bodies are made from her body. We only borrow them from a moment and we eventually return. She breathes in, we are born. She breathes out, we go back. We are made from nature, but we are no longer natural. Another world still exists alongside us, living and breathing through fur, claw, leaf and root. Whenever a wild creature crosses our path, it is a reminder that magic endures. Patiently waiting beneath the concrete, passing through the gardens filled with non-native plants. On the edges of the spruce woods where the light still sings the land back to life. It's still hiding in the wisps of wild places where we haven't managed to tidy up or wipe out yet. There are 2 million gardens in Ireland, By reweaving them with native plant communities, our gardens can be beacons of hope for fox, the owl, the shrew, and all the others that have been pushed out. Here on my land, I have learned how quickly nature can recover with a little support. Instead of making a garden, I have restored its true nature. A diverse community of Irish plants. These plants are our lost heritage, our shared kin. The recovery of nature here in my patch of this planet, its thriving, breathing beauty, this is what keeps me going. Perhaps it's time for us all to pledge our allegiance to the trees and their communities. Time to become guardians, not gardeners.
Mary Reynolds there, and she is at Wild Mary Mary on Instagram. Well, that's it for this week. My thanks to Amandine Passett-Devine, our broadcast coordinator, Paul Murnock on sound, Martina McGlynn produced. Playback is on the way. Have a brilliant weekend.
Countrywide on RTE Radio 1. Listen back on the RTE Radio Player.